Day. This week's Towaway has been sponsored by Sid Goldschmidt of Fairlawn, New Jersey, in honour of Adam Lasky, Joey Joseph, and the Start Your Day, the Towaway website. Kof Zion Tammuz, Thursday the 28th of July, Rabbi Yehuda Landi, the historical background of Sefer Yirmiyahu.
Good morning, everyone. It's always a pleasure to come back here. And as announced, today we're going to discuss the historical background of Sefer Yirmiyahu. When I, a year and a half ago, I published my Sefer on Megillas Esther, so people asked me, what's next? So I said there are a few possibilities, and when I mentioned possibility of a book on Sefer Yirmiyahu, so someone says to me, well, no one learns Sefer Yirmiyahu. I said, that's exactly why we want to write a book on it, that people will start. Sefer Yirmiyahu is not an easy Sefer to learn, but I believe that with understanding the political and historical background of what's happening, it can change and give much more insight and depth to understanding what's going on. When we read the Prakim one after another, which are not even in chronological order, some don't have any chronological date to them, but some do, they're not in chronological order, so it can be very confusing and difficult in understanding. So what we're going to do is discuss the background and see certain events and compare it with the historical and archaeological findings, and we can discover some very interesting things. The main king, we read this in the Haftarah last week, Divrei Yirmiyahu ben Chilkiyahu, min HaKoyanim Hashav HaNasois Ve'eretz Binyamin. Asher Yadvar Hashem Elov B'mei Yoshio V'Namayin Melech Yehuda V'Shloshes V'Shan Ha'la Molchoi. He began his Nebuah in the 13th year of King Yoshiyahu. First of all, important to mention, Yirmiyahu was min HaKohanim Hashav HaNasois, not just a Kohen, but Yirmiyahu ben Chilkiyahu. And Chilkiyahu, as we see in Melachim Beis and in Divrei Hayomim, he was the Kohen Gadol in the time of Yoshiyahu. In Melachim Beis, Kof Gimel Dalet, by Tzavah Melachis Chilkiyahu, a Kohen Gadol, he was the Kohen Gadol. So safe to assume that this Yirmiyahu ben Chilkiyahu is the son of the Kohen Gadol. Yirmiyahu didn't become Kohen Gadol. Another son, Azariah ben Chilkiyahu, he became Kohen Gadol, and we know the list of Kohen Gadolim, it's all listed in Divrei Hayomim. So it was Azariah, who was probably Kohen Gadol in the time of Yehoyakim, and later on in the time of Tzidkiyahu, the final king, was his son, Sreyah, who we know from the end of Sefer Yirmiyahu was the Kohen Gadol at the time of the Churban and killed by Nebuchadnezzar. Chazal compare Yirmiyahu to Moshe Rabbeinu. They say there's a lot of comparisons, and one of them is that Moshe Rabbeinu gave Nevuah for 40 years. His Nevuah begins, Pashas Ve'ero, Moshe ben Shmonim Shana Ba'amdof Meparo. He's 80 years old, and he passed away at 120, that's 40 years. And likewise, Yirmiyahu gives Nevuah for 40 years. He begins in the 13th year of Yoshiyahu. Yoshiyahu was killed, and we'll talk about that in a moment, in the 31st year of his reign, that gives 18 years, and Yehoyakim and Zedekiah respectively each ruled for 11 years, that's another 22, that's a total of 40. In the meantime, we have two other kings who ruled for a short while, 3 months apiece, so that doesn't add up to a year. So we're talking about 40 years of their reign. I would say the most important event that shaped the history of Sefer Yirmiyahu is an event that's not even mentioned at all in Sefer Yirmiyahu, and that is the sudden collapse of the Assyrian Empire. Ashur had been the dominant empire for hundreds of years. And in Tanakh, of course, we have the events of the king of Ashur who captures Shamrayim, the 10 tribes, sends them into Golus. That event we know. Later on, Sanherib comes to Yehuda and his army is all wiped out one night outside Yerushalayim. Ashur is the dominant empire. Now, beside the Assyrians, they left us very detailed documents of their historical war campaigns. And they began a lot before they're mentioned in Tanakh, from the days of Achav. From the days of Achav Melech Yisrael, they're already not only coming to power, but they already came into contact with Achav, not directly, but indirectly. And we won't talk a lot about that, but we have a very interesting story of Achav, as has to do with Haftarah of Parshas Pinchas, which we read this year, pretty rare. Achav, long story, not going into details, but he goes to war against Ben-Hadad. He captures the Aramean king of Ben-Hadad. He got instructions, and when he captures him, he got instructions on the Navi to kill him, and he did not. And for 3 years, there's no war between Achav and Ben-Hadad. And so later on, he goes to war again, and then Achav is killed. And we know today that during those 3 years, the Assyrians were rising to power, and Ben-Hadad and Achav teamed up together. They made a coalition and went to war against the Assyrians. And we know this from Assyrian documentation. Now, for another 100 years, the Assyrian advancement was held in check. But afterwards, the Assyrian Empire rose to its greatest peak, capturing Eretz Yisrael and even capturing Egypt. Capturing Egypt, you have to understand, in those days was something unprecedented, because it meant you had to take a whole army and march it across the Sinai Desert. How do you have water to supply to take it across the Sinai Desert? So it was close to impossible. And the first king who was able to do this was King Esarhaddon, the son of Sennacherib. He took, we know this from Assyrian documentation, he took a whole army together with a whole units of camels, and on them he had water, and that's how he was able to cross into Egypt and capture Egypt. So Ashur is a dominant power for hundreds of years. And suddenly here, Ashur no longer exists. Suddenly, the big players in Sefer Yirmiyahu are the Egyptians and the Babylonians. So this is the demise of the Assyrian Empire and the demise of Nineveh. Yirmiyahu does not talk about Nineveh, but there were two other Nevi'im who were around the time of Yirmiyahu, and one was the Navi Tzfania, the Nei Yoshiyahu and Amon, the same time. And he, between his Nevuahs, talks about what's going to happen to Nineveh. And we have Nachum, it doesn't say when he was, who was whole three prokem, talking about the upcoming destruction of Nineveh. So the destruction of, the collapse of the Egyptian Empire, of the Assyrian Empire, and the destruction of Nineveh is actually a thing that probably plays the largest role over here in these events. Now, Yoshiyahu HaMelech became the Sefer Torah was discovered in his days. His father Amon was a tremendous Rasha, and he destroyed all the Sefer Torah, but one of them was hidden in the Beis HaMikdash, and when Yoshiyahu ordered to do a reconstruction to fix up the Beis HaMikdash, the Sefer Torah was discovered, and Yoshiyahu read, it happened to be open to the Pasuk, to the Tochacha, in Parshas Kisavo, Yolech Hashem Oscha, V'esmalkecho Hashem Mekim Alecho, El Goya Shalor Yadata, Hashem will take you and your king into Golos. He realized what's going to happen here. He sent messengers to Chulda Hanaviyah to ask her what to do, and she said, indeed, the harsh stuff that you read is going to happen, but since you did tshuva, you tore your clothing, you will die peacefully. The Churban will only happen in the next generation. It's interesting because we have in Chazal that the pasuk says Ki Yireach Yikon Kiso, the throne of David HaMelech will be like the moon. So what's special about the moon? The moon begins a month very small and slowly rises and gets larger, larger, larger until the 15th of the month. And the 15th, it starts its demise, smaller, 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 etc. So the Medrash has that from Avram Avinu until David HaMelech, we have 15 generations. Until Shlomo, we have 15 generations. And those represents rising to the peak. And from Shlomo HaMelech, it was all downhill. And at the end, it was lights out. When was lights out? V'tzidkiyo. V'seine tzidkiyo iver. Tzidkiyo was punished by Nebuchadnezzar that his eyes were blinded. So that's what Chazal say. But the truth of the matter is, if you calculate it, I'm not going to go into the whole calculation, it's a little more than 15. Where the extra? The answer is that really Yoshiyahu was supposed to be the king who the Churban was going to happen in his days, and he's actually the 15th. But Hashem delayed it a little because Yoshiyahu did tshuva. So Yoshiyahu did a tremendous tshuva, and it's described in detail in Melachim Beis, Perek of Gimel. Without going into all the detail, he describes how Yoshiyahu goes around and removes and demolishes and destroys all the Avodah Zarah that have been in Eretz Yisrael. So he did two special things over here. There were kings before him who got rid of the Avodah Zarah, but two things. One is the area that he covered in this operation. He not only got rid of the Avodah Zarah in Yehuda, which was his kingdom, but he got rid of the Avodah Zarah that were in the northern part of Eretz Yisrael as well. Let's not forget, the northern part of Eretz Yisrael was an entirely different kingdom. The Ten Shvatim, it was an entirely different kingdom for hundreds of years. And here, Yoshio, as a Jewish king, goes and gets rid of all these Avodah Zarah, which are in areas seemingly not under his control. It talks about Beit El, it talks about Shomron. These are areas that are not even in his control. That's one. And the second thing that he did, very interesting, is that the description in Malachim Beis Chav Gimel talks about the destruction, v'natatz. He smashes this Avodah Zarah, he smashes this Mizbeach. It always gives the term v'natatz, to smash. But there are three exceptions, and in these exceptions it says v'timei, he defiled. It doesn't say that he smashed. And one of these exceptions, one of them, are the bamos. The bamos, what are the bamos? The bamos are mizbechos that were used to be makriv l'shem shamayim. Not of a dessert. But the problem with them was that they weren't in Yerushalayim, in the Beis HaMikdash. Once Yerushalayim was chosen, Yerushalayim is the only place where one can bring a carbon. And if he brings a carbon outside Yerushalayim, it's a prohibition of Shchut Echutz, which is Chayav Kares, but it's not of a dessert. There's no skila. Of a dessert is much worse. Nonetheless, throughout almost all the kings in the history, the Pasuk reiterates, even the good kings, also Yehoshaphat, who got rid of all the Avodah Zarah, but the Bamos, they were not able to get rid of, for whatever reason. The first king who tried getting rid of them was King Chizkiyahu, which is one of the later kings, and the one who finally got rid of them is King Yoshiyahu. But the interesting thing is that it doesn't say over here, it doesn't say that he smashed it, just like he did with the Avodah Zarah. It says with teammate. The Radak is the first one I know of to already approach this issue and mention the fact that these bamos, although negative, the fact that they were outside of Yerushalayim, but on the other hand, they were used to be makav korbanos to Hashem. And on such a bama, you cannot destroy it because it was used to be makav l'shem shamayim. So therefore, v'timei means he defiled it, meaning he put it off limits. Don't go over here, don't use it, but he didn't destroy it. Interestingly, the Rashi raised similar in the Haftarah Parshas Pinchas, which, as I said, we read this year. Eliyahu Navi gets up and says, "As mizbechosecha harasu, they destroyed your mizbechos." Eliyahu Navi is complaining about what's happening to him. He says, "Ki azvu brischa bnei Yisrael, they have left your bris, as mizbechosecha harasu, they have destroyed your mizbechos." So Rashi is bothered. What do you mean they destroyed your mizbechos? We have one mizbech, and that's in Yerushalayim, and that mizbech is still existing in the time of Eliyahu HaNavi. So which mizbech are we referring to? So Rashi says we're referring to bamos that were done l'shem shamayim. There was a bama that was used to be makif to Hashem, and Eliyahu HaNavi is saying as a negative, as mizbechosecha harasu, they've destroyed your bamos. So we see from here, and the Chasam Sofer already, I think, I'm told, says this point, that a mizbeach done Hashem Shemaim, even if it's outside Yerushalayim, you can't destroy it. Now what's interesting is that one of these bamas has been discovered in archaeological excavations in the city of Arad, the Tel Arad, and over there they actually found a bama, which is probably Hashem Shemaim. The mizbeach fit the description of the Torah, the stones were not chiseled, it was square, and over there they found that when this mizbeach was put out of commission, he just covered it with layers and layers of dirt. It wasn't smashed like found in other areas nearby. So this is an example. The Bama of Arad is an example of one of these mizbechos that Yoshiyahu put out of commission but didn't destroy. Yoshiyahu did all these wonderful things, and nonetheless, his end was not very good. The end of Perchov Gimel, B'yom Avala Paro Nechol Melech Mitzrayim Al Melech Ashur Nahapras And his days, Paranacho went Al Melech Ashur to Nahar Pras, and Yeshua went to meet him, and Yeshua was killed by Paranacho in Megiddo. The death of Yeshua was a terrible blow to Am Yisrael, which they never recovered from. It was basically the beginning of the end. What's interesting in the Pasuk is that the Pasuk says he went, where's Paro coming from? He's coming from Egypt, and he's going to the Euphrates, which is all the way up in the border between Syria and Turkey. Inevitably, he's going to have to cross to Eretz Yisrael. But his intentions are not to go to war against Yoshiyahu. His intentions are to get across Eretz Yisrael. And that, Chazal say, in Gemara and Titus, that Yoshiyahu felt that since he made Klai Yisrael do tshuva, Klai Yisrael is on a high madriga, and they have the blessing of Pashas B'chukosai, V'cherev lo sava ba'artzichem. A sword shall not pass through your land, which is referring to even someone passing through to get to another country, even if they're not going to war against you. So he felt Klai Yisrael was on this madriga, and therefore he can stop Paro, even though Paro has superior forces beyond any doubt. And in the end, Yoshiyahu was killed. The Gemara also says in Tanya he didn't listen to the Navi. That's an issue in itself. It's hard to believe Yirmiyahu told him not to go, but it could be Yirmiyahu advised him that, you know, you're not on the Madrega, or Am Yisrael is not on the Madrega that you really think it is. What's an interesting thing is in this Pasuk, is the Pasuk says that he went to war Al Melech Ashur. He went to war on Melech Ashur. Now, the terminology is a little strange. What does it mean, Al Melech Ashur? If he went to war against the king of Ashur, maybe it should say Neged Melech Ashur or something like that. What does it mean, Al Melech Ashur? Now, what's interesting is like this. We know today from Babylonian documents, and the Babylonians didn't leave us so much historical material like the Assyrians did, but there are a few historical tablets from the time. And one of them has a story of how the Babylonians defeated the Assyrians. They're the ones who destroyed Nineveh, together with the Medes, with Marduk. The Medes and the Babylonians are the ones who teamed up on Ashur and destroyed Nineveh. And by the way, the excavations in Nineveh showed the city was destroyed totally, like the Nevuah of Tzfania. Nothing was left of it. The palaces that were there, the Assyrian palaces, were burned. Fire raged over there, probably over 1,000 degrees. They even found skeletons of people who were killed in this war. That's recently, last 20 years. But according to the Babylonian records, what happens is that the Assyrian king runs away from Nineveh, and he runs east to the city of Choron, which is near the Pras. And when he runs there, suddenly, who comes to his assistance? The Egyptian king. The Egyptian king takes his whole army across the Sinai, across Eretz Israel, to help the Assyrian king. Why does he want to help the Assyrian king? As I mentioned before, the Assyrians and Egyptians have been at war. Well, that's again that everyone's getting in political position when the Assyrian Empire collapses. The Babylonians want to take over the Assyrian Empire and be in control of Eretz Israel as well, while the Egyptians probably want to stop it. So if he teams up with the Assyrian king that can stop the Babylonian advancement, he'll be in better position. So the Pasuk says Al Melech Ashur, which seemingly means he went to war against Melech Ashur, but we know from historical documentation it means he went to war to assist the Assyrian king. If I just compare it to two ancient sources, we find a very interesting thing. One of the earliest, you could say, interpretations of Tanakh, not necessarily Jewish, is the Septuagint, the Targum HaShivim, which we know the story from in Maseches Megillah, time of Talmud HaMelech, but they're talking about the Chumash, and later on, the whole Tanakh was translated into Greek. And there, those translating the Tanakh into Greek, they got it wrong. They misinterpreted the Pasuk. They read it the way it seemingly means that he went to war against Melech Ashur. On the other hand, we have Josephus, a historian from Bayesheni, who wrote his book Antiquities of the Jews, in which he goes through all of Jewish history based on Tanakh, and he somehow knew this interpretation, and he talks about Paradacho going to war with to assist Ashur against Babel and Modai. How he knew it is a good question. We don't have any satisfactory answer. But anyway, we see from these historical documents that the interpretation should be that he went to war to assist the Assyrian king and not against the Assyrian king. Okay, what happens afterwards? Afterwards, what happens is Vayikach Amaretz es Yehoachaz ben Yoshio vayimshichu oso. The Amaretz, the people take Yehoachaz, the son of Yoshio, and anoint him and make him into king. Why do they have to anoint him? The rule is Marquises and Hurrius that a king who succeeds his father, you don't have to be Moshech im Shemen HaMishcha. The Shemen HaMishcha is used for a Kohen Gadol. Any Kohen Gadol who is appointed is anointed with Shemen HaMishcha. A king, if he's the first king, you have to anoint him. But if he's succeeding his father, then you don't have to anoint him. So why do they anoint him here? So Chazal tell us that he wasn't next in line to the throne. And therefore, if you anoint a king, and there is a little dispute, who should be king, then you have to anoint the king, in other words, to show that this was the king. So Yehoachaz was not the first in line to the throne. Yehoiakim, his brother, was older than him, as is clear from the Pesukim. Yehoiakim should have been king, but the people instead, they took Yehoachaz and appointed him king. Why did they take him? So probably Yehoachaz was better off than Yehoiakim. Yehoiakim was a very evil person, as we've seen in Yehoah, but it also can have its political effect. It could be that Yehoachaz was once again following Yoshio's policies against Paro. And Paro was not happy with this, and when Paro came back from the war, he summons Yehoachaz to Rivla, to Lebanon, and after 3 months, he demotes him, he takes him to Egypt, never to be heard of again, and appoints Yehoiakim as king. Now, what happens, what do we know from Babylonian records? What do we know happens during these years? So in the first few battles between the Egyptians, Egyptian Assyrian versus Babylonians, it's pretty much a stalemate. At Nahar Pras, that's where the boundary remains, the Euphrates, there's a little skirmishes back and forth, but the Egyptians remain in the land for the next 4 years. During this time period, the Babylonian king, Nebuchadnezzar, dies, and his eldest son, Nebuchadnezzar, becomes king. And when he becomes king, or even slightly before he became king, he takes control of the Babylonian army, and when he goes to war, he wins. And in the first year, he actually gets rid of the Egyptian forces in the whole area of Elchama, which is in Syria today. He gets rid of the Egyptian forces. And the next year, he actually ousts all the Egyptian forces from all of Eretz Israel. And Paro will no longer come into Eretz Israel. Now this, of course, creates a big difficulty for Yehoachaz, for Yehoiakim. Because what is Yehoiakim going to do? He is loyal to Paro because Paro is the one who appointed him. But on the other hand, now he suddenly finds the Nebuchadnezzar's coming. So you gotta play your cards the right way. You gotta be with the winning force. So of course he's desirous to be with Paro, but he's going to have no choice. And in Yirmiyahu, we find a very interesting... we find a story... quickly enough. We find the story that Hashem tells Yirmiyahu to write down all the nevuos that he had been told. And Yirmiyahu, in that process, also writes Sefer Eicha. He writes Sefer Eicha before the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed. and he's instructed, I'll find the parakeh momentarily, he's instructed to, he was in jail, at the time of Yoriakim, he's in jail, and he instructs Baruch ben Neriah, his Talmud, his scribe, to take this Megillah and read it in front of the people in the Beis HaMikdash, Biyom Tzom, on a day of fasting. Maybe the people will hear this and they will do tshuva. And Baruch ben Neriah takes this scroll, he takes it to the Beis HaMikdash, and he reads it in the Beis HaMikdash, Biyom Tzom, on a fast, and the description of the story takes place in the ninth month, in the fifth year of Yoyakim's reign. What prompted this sudden fast, the pasuk doesn't tell us. The end of the story was that he reads the Megillah, and the people heard, it had a profound effect on them, and the few people who were present at the time were some ministers of King Yoyakim. And the ministers of King Yoyakim, Yoyakim, as we said, was a very big Russia. But the ministers of King Yoyakim, they were righteous, they were tzaddikim. So they said to themselves, you know what, maybe we're going to read this for the king, and maybe the king will listen and do tshuva. So they bring the scroll to the king, and they read it. Yoyakim did not like what he heard, and that's a long story in itself. He takes the scroll straight into the fire. He burns the scroll, and that day, in Kislev, he burns the scroll on the fire. It was a cold winter day in Yerushalayim. He burns the scroll on the fire. What is the background? What do we know from the Babylonian records? We know as following. Exactly at that time that we're talking about, Kislev, the fifth year of Yehoyakim, which happened to be the second year of Nebuchadnezzar, exactly that time, Nebuchadnezzar is coming to capture all of Eretz Israel. The year before that, we said, he ousted the Egyptian forces from Syria, and this year, he's going to capture all of Eretz Israel. And that, of course, puts Yehoyakim in a very difficult position. Is he going to fight Nebuchadnezzar? Is he going to resist? Or will he just go and express loyalty to Nebuchadnezzar? It could be when he saw what Nebuchadnezzar did to Ashkelon, I don't think he had any doubts. Nebuchadnezzar describes, I went to Ashkelon, of course it could have just as well been Yerushalayim or any other city in Israel. Says, I went to Ashkelon and I destroyed that city and I left it in a heap of ruins. And that description is no exaggeration. Excavations at Ashkelon show, once again, that city was destroyed with a tremendous fire. And again, we can't, of course, archaeology cannot tell us exactly the year when it happened, but it fits pretty much this description of the conquest in the days of Yehoyakim. So Nebuchadnezzar comes, and Yehoyakim expresses his loyalty to Nebuchadnezzar and probably brought him tribute or attacks, whatever you want to call it. And from now on, he is loyal to Nebuchadnezzar. But of course, he may be loyal physically, but his mind is to go to Paro or maybe perhaps even to be independent. Now, what we know from this tablet, it's known as the Babylonian Chronicle. It's in the British Museum here in London. Recently been touring in Abu Dhabi, but I'm just told that it came back finally. And it talks about the first 11 years of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, what he did in the first 11 years. Now, this is the only historical document, pretty much, that we have from the time of Nebuchadnezzar. So we don't have what happened in his 18th or 19th year when they destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. We don't have such a historical document. We have the first 11 years. Now, what happens is, the 3 years from when Yoyakim is under control of Nebuchadnezzar, as the pasuk says, these 3 years, Nebuchadnezzar roams Eretz Israel, collecting taxes. Every year, he leaves his capital in Babel, comes all the way to Eretz Israel or Syria, collects taxes, and goes back. He doesn't trust anyone. He personally comes to collect it. But in the 3rd year after he conquered Yoyakim, he decides it's time to make a big move. And what's his big move? He's going to try and capture Egypt. And once again, to capture Egypt means have to put together a whole army, a lot of water, logistics are very complicated. He takes his whole army, he probably crossed the Sinai Desert and went to war against the Egyptians. But he did not win this war. I mean, that's clear from the Babylonian statement. The Babylonian tablet will not tell us that he lost the war, but we'll soon see it's clear that he lost the war. And probably his entire army was wiped out in this opportunity. But he definitely did not win. The next year, the Babylonian tablet says, what did Nebuchadnezzar do? He stayed in his country, and he's putting together a new army. Which is already telling you what happened to his previous army. Of the whole 11 years, there's not one mention of a year that the king stayed at home, did do nothing. He's always on the move and always going to war here and there. And except this particular year. And that's probably the year that Jehoiakim seizes the opportunity to rebel against Nebuchadnezzar. He rebels against him for 3 years. He rebels against him for 3 years. This we know from Tanakh. And in the seventh year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar comes and goes to war against Jehoiakim. Jehoiakim is taken prisoner and died instantly. And his son, Yechoniah, is appointed king. Yechoniah lasts for 3 months. Nebuchadnezzar comes back again and takes him prisoner to Babel. Now these things we know from Tanakh. It's interestingly, once again, it appears in the Babylonian Chronicle as well. It says that he came to Eir Yehuda, which is the city of Judah, which is Yerushalayim, of course. He took the king, he appointed a new king of his liking, took a lot of spoils, and went to Babel. So he took a lot of people, he took the elite of the army, he took the elite of the Jewish people, he took them to Babel. Amongst those people, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, Daniel, Mordechai, Yechezkel Hanavi, all these people are sitting in Babel 11 years before the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. That is the goal of Yechoniah. So if we compare this to Babylonian records, it's running a little late, first of all, we have the Golas Yechoniah. The story of Golas Yechoniah appears in Babylonian records. That's one, and a very interesting piece of information. The story of Yirmiyah ends after the Churban. It says when Nebuchadnezzar died. When Nebuchadnezzar died, then his son Evil Merodach takes Yechoniah out of prison. Yechoniah had been in prison 37 years, and when he comes. 37 years, and at the end of the 37 years, Nebuchadnezzar dies, and Evil Merodach takes him out of jail, and not only that, Vaydabri Totovos, Vayitin his Kisa, Mimal, Kisa, Mlach, Vashayito, Vashina is Bigdechilo, he gave him new garments, Vachal Lechem, the fun of Tamit, Kodem Echayov, and he ate bread in his presence all of his life. All his life, every day, he got provisions from the king. So I want to mention two things. One is that in excavations in Babel, they actually found, in one corner of the palaces of Nebuchadnezzar, they actually found vaults. And there are no vaults in the rest of all of Babel, no vaults have been found. And in these vaults, they actually found tablets. And the tablets have listings of the food provisions given to the family of Yechoniah Melech Yehuda. Now these provisions are, these tablets are in the Pergamon Museum in Berlin, a bunch of them, some published, some not, but it's interesting, it mentions Yechoniah Melech Yehuda and his family, it mentions how they got food. My assumption is, when these walls were discovered, everyone decided they must have been the Hanging Gardens of Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon, which no one knows if they really existed or not. But I believe that these vaults are none other than the prison. This was the jail. And Yechoniah, who had some royal, was royal, he got royal treatment. He had his own prison on the compound of Nebuchadnezzar's palaces. I just want to finish off with an amazing story that happened to me here in London at the British Museum. The second in command, expert in cuneiform, Dr. Irving Finkel, I'm good friends with, and every time I meet, he always comes up to me with some new ideas. So he says to me, why do you think it is that Avil Merodach not only pardons Yechoniah. Okay, he pardoned him after 37 years in jail. He's no threat. But he gives him royal status. He puts him on the royal table. He gives him the food to eat. Why do you think such a thing can happen? I said, that's a good question. What do you say? He says, well, we have a document. It's called the Chronicle of Rachmael, which is from about the 12th century. And in it, it has a very interesting story. It says like this. We know from Daniel that Nebuchadnezzar turned into an animal for 7 years. And during those 7 years, who's going to run the country? So his son, Evil Merodach, became king. When Nebuchadnezzar came back after 7 years, realizing Hashem is king and he did tshuva, so he suddenly comes and he finds Evil Merodach sitting on his throne. Nebuchadnezzar was furious. He takes this Evil Merodach and he puts him in jail. He puts him in jail, accusing him of trying to overthrow him, etc. He puts him in jail. Now this appears in the Chronicle of Rachmael. It appears in some editions of the Targum Sheni on Megillas Esther, not in all of them. So he says, well, he says, you know, my idea is that when Avil Merodach was in jail, he was in jail together with Yechoniah. And because they were in jail together, they became friends, and afterwards he took him out of prison. He says, why do I think this? He says, because I found a Babylonian tablet, and he's an expert on cuneiform. I found a Babylonian tablet, and we have over there a prayer from a son of the Nebuchadnezzar who's in prison on charges which he claims are false. Now the name over there is not Avil Merodach, but that's a side issue. Not a big kasha. But anyway, he says, this tablet is telling you about this the son of the king, the prince, who's in jail, a son of Nebuchadnezzar. That's the story. So I heard that. I said, yeah, that's a very interesting theory. A few weeks later, I emailed them. They were busy preparing a special exhibition on Babylon a few years ago, and the department was closed for months. Everyone was busy with this exhibition, and I sent them an email. I said, I promise I'm not going to bother you till the exhibition, but this thing I got to tell you. So give me a time and I can call you. And okay, finally, back and forth with emails, we got together on the phone. I said, I want you to tell me exactly what you said to me then. And he tells me over the whole story exactly. I said, well, there's a manuscript, there's a sefer called Perash HaRambam on Megillas Esther. Now whether this is actually from the Rambam or not is a good question, because the style of Perash over here is not typical for the Rambam. But it's called Perash HaRambam on Megillas Esther. It's printed from an ancient manuscript, printed once 50 years ago, I think reprinted about 10 years ago. And there, the Rambam says exactly what you said. The Rambam says that Avil Merodach was in jail together with Yechoniah, and that's why he promised him that when he'll become king, he'll pardon him and take him out of jail. He could overcome his excitement. He says, well, this is amazing. This is amazing. Anyway, so that's the background of the story. And Am Yisrael had tough times, but Baruch Hashem, as Yirmiyahu promised, the good times will come also.